unalloyed, no mixture whatsoever. Sometimes it's used with the adjective akeratos, which means unadulterated or unalloyed. And akeratos used with katharos oftentimes is used in speaking of wine or milk that has not been mixed with anything else. Sometimes wine was cut with water. Sometimes milk was cut with water to make it go further, but also for young children, the milk might be cut with water. So it was not unadulterated milk or wine. It had something else in it. What Jesus received on the cross, the soured wine or the wine mixed with myrrh, was not pure wine. It was not unadulterated or unalloyed. It had something else with it. So it could not have been spoken of as akeratos katharos, pure and clean and unadulterated. So here, when this word is being used, it's very similar to the idea in Hebrew thought that the pure in heart are those whose devotion to God is unalloyed. That is, it's not mixed. Their devotion to God, the pure in heart, are totally devoted to God with all of their being, with all of who they are, and nothing else gets in the way. It's also very similar to Psalm 24:4. If you go there and you read that verse, it says, and it's quoted here on the sheet, in part anyway, "Those who have clean hands and pure hearts, who do not lift up their souls to what is false, and do not swear deceitfully." And that goes along with the idea that it's someone that has more than just, they're more than just morally pure, but their heart, the heart is the seat of decisions. The heart and the mind go together. That is, to be pure-minded as well. To not intentionally go out and treat people deceitfully. Those are the pure in heart. Those who have, they're the ones who have clean hands. And oftentimes in the Hebrew Scriptures, and we especially found in studying Exodus and Leviticus, and even in Isaiah, in our Isaiah study, that clean hands and pure hearts go together, because the pure heart is where the intention is and the hands are where the actions come in. So clean hands coming from pure hearts. Some scholars say that the pure hearted are innocent of moral failure and evil intentions. So which one of us will qualify for that blessing throughout our lives? Okay, nobody spoke up. Okay. Sarah said no one, and Ed chuckled. So who would qualify? No one. In fact, some people have said, well, this is the most unattainable for human beings, most unattainable of all the Beatitudes. You might be able to reach some of the others, but nobody can reach this one, because who can be pure-hearted? Who cannot have some kind of bad thought or evil intent or deceitfulness at some point in their lives? I don't know of anyone. I know some very good people. But at some point in all of our lives, from the time we were born until where we are now, that would be someone who had never done anything wrong, deceitfully, or intentionally to hurt somebody else. You've got Enoch. Enoch was he walked with God, and when it came for him to die, the text said, and he was no more. And then Noah was said to be pure and blameless in his generation. And that's why he got saved out, he and his family. It's that whole kind of elusive thing that we deal with, but in part because we're human beings and we have that human nature. I guess part of the question here, especially when it comes to our religion and being pure of heart and having clean hands, one of the questions that comes up is our religion a thing in which we are conscious of nothing so much as the need of God in our hearts? In other words, to be pure-hearted means, in our religious life, means that the only thing that matters and the only thing of which we are conscious is our need for God within our hearts. That's the number one thing. Then the next thing that follows is how we don't measure up in the need for forgiveness and to try and work with God, because God can cleanse us of things, but then God expects us to live accordingly, which means that we are daily having to cleanse our hearts, cleanse our hands, be purified by God. Or do we get so comfortable in our own piety that we think we've made it, or we don't need any of this? So the pure in heart are those who truly seek to live their lives without evil intent, recognizing their moral failures, trying to fulfill the law of God in treating others with pureness and fairness and cleanliness of heart and mind. If you go to some of the rabbinic commentaries, they're called the Pesharim. Some of the rabbinic commentaries on Psalms. And it's really kind of interesting. Within Orthodox Judaism, actually, it's more important in Orthodox Judaism to study and learn and know all about the various comments and commentaries that have been written about the law than it is to study the law itself. Within conservative Judaism, and especially in Reform Judaism, it's more important to learn what the law says and then study the commentaries by the rabbis and the philosophers over the years as a secondary thing. But in Orthodox Judaism, the pride is taken in knowing what the commentators have had to say and knowing what all the rabbis have had to say. I've got a photocopy, I meant to bring that over, in a file in my office, but it's from a commentary, a Pesharim, on a particular verse in the Bible. And in the center of the page, you have a page like this. And in the center of the page, right here, is just a little place where the Hebrew text is with the scripture verse. And then, starting in this quadrant, sometimes, or sometimes starting just above, you'll have commentary, and the commentary will start wrapping around that, and then it'll come over and the commentary will go like this, and that's one commentator. And then there'll be another commentator that'll reply not only to the scripture but reply to that one that'll start right over here and go down. And then there's another one that'll comment on the scripture and this one and here, and it's all over the page and all around the edges of the page, all these different commentators and things on that particular verse. For Orthodox Judaism, you are considered a true doctor of the law if you can study and understand and quote the commentary, not because you can quote the law, but you can quote the commentary. So the commentary can become more important than even the text itself. But according to some rabbinic commentaries on both Psalm 24 and if you go to Psalm 73:1, talking about those who will see God, such as are of a clean heart, states, this means those whose heart is strong through fulfilling the law. And so it's not just knowing God, but fulfilling the statutes, doing the sacrifices, and that kind of thing. Old Testament theologian Sherman Johnson writes that, and I quote, the phrase almost means those who are right with God, those who with singleness of mind try to do God's will. Those are the ones with a clean heart. They try to do God's will, not just know God's will. So to have a clean heart, a pure heart, and as Jesus would have been speaking, to have a pure heart would be not just to say that you believe in God, not just to know what the law says or what the commentators say, but then that influences what you do with your life in the law. The pure-hearted aren't just morally perfect, as no one is. They don't just do what is good, but the pure in heart seek to do what is good because they are single-minded with God. So it's about being pure-minded. It's where our thoughts and God's thoughts coincide to the point that it's not, okay, God, this is what I really think, what I really wish, so you can get in line and agree with it. It's we understand what God really wants and what God's really saying, and even though we may not be there yet or it might not be comfortable for us, we try to mesh our understanding with that of God. That's hard to do. That's hard to do. Heart in the Semitic understanding. includes the mind, the will, and the emotions. You know, we think of the heart, I love you with all my heart, as an emotional kind of thing. But within the Hebrew understanding, the Semitic understanding in the Middle East, and particularly in the ancient Middle East, the heart did involve emotions, but the heart was also more involved with the mind and the will even than it was the emotion. And so the heart in the center of your chest, the heart was the place where you made your deepest and most important decisions. They came from the bottom of your heart. The emotion of love came from your bowel, because your stomach got all churny when you were around somebody that you cared about. But love came from there. But to truly be devoted to someone with the heart, that means you made a conscious decision within that. Well, the clutter is there, but a part of what you're trying to do, Ed, is not just... the clutter might be there, but you try to... When it comes up, you try your best to push it back and to think on other things and do other actions. Right. Right. Rather than focusing on that to the point where when it starts coming up, you push it aside to where it comes up less and less. Yeah. I mean, it's obvious that even things that are trivia that go into your brain a lot of times just pop out there. Just listen to me for a while talk. You know, I mean, all kinds of trivia in there. But it takes a conscious effort. You don't say, oh, well, hey, you know, that thought's there, but so what? But it takes a conscious effort when it comes up, a conscious effort of will to control that part of your mind as well. G.A. Buttrick says pure probably means rightness of mind and singleness of motive as well. It's not just to have your mind right, but a singleness of motive in connection with God. Chastity and charity were the marks of early Christianity, and chastity was as winning a virtue as charity, because it gave a pagan world release from a more consuming bondage. A pagan world release from more in the ancient world. I mean, we've used unchastity to sell cars, and at the fights, who is it? It's not the short, dumpy, bald-headed guy that has more hair than a gorilla that walks around at boxing matches carrying the sign, is it? It's a woman that hardly got any clothes on that's walking around carrying the sign to tell you what round it is. That kind of thing. So, yeah, but chastity was, and probably today would be, as great as charity, love and care, if it would bring us release from all of the other stuff that clutters. We need to examine our motives. And that's what it talks about being pure-hearted is. Your motive is examined. Your motive is pure and clean and good, and your actions flow out of your motive. And there's a promise. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. If our motives get that way, then our actions are more that way. And we are told that they will see God. Now that was, while most people think this promise is for the end, eschatology, the end of time, God will permit people to see Him face to face in the age to come. It's also clear here, I think, that there must be personal holiness in order to be in the presence of God now and to truly see God now, to understand what God is doing now. I think, in my little handwritten notes here, Jesus probably also meant the pure in heart see God in the world around them when others are blind to God's presence. They will be aware of the movement of God's will in lives, even in the midst of pain. They will have the leading of God's Spirit when others seem not to have it. The pure in heart will find God in places in the world that other people don't see God. The pure in heart will find God's will guiding them when other people can't seem to find their way. Now, this was a very radical statement, though, to see God in Jesus' day. To see God, and you go back to the Old Testament. When Jacob wrestles with the angel all night long, and then the next day the angel leaves him and he realizes, oh, wait a minute, his name's been changed from Jacob to Israel, which means he who struggles with God. He named the place Peniel, which means face of God. He said, for behold, I have seen God, and yet I still live. There was this whole idea that the human mind could not comprehend and the human presence could not stand in the presence of God. And so for Jesus to stand here and say, the pure in heart will see God, and that doesn't just mean they're going to see Him at the judgment when He's, you know, standing over them, judging them, but they can see God face to face without having to be scared. Why? Because their motives, their will, is in harmony with that of God. Seeing God is not just a physical thing, nor, as Johnson says, nor is it metaphorical as in worshiping in His house. There were folks who thought seeing God meant that you went to the house of God, you went to the temple, and as you looked at the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from where you were sitting, in essence, when you looked at the curtain, you were picturing God behind that curtain. Oh, the great powerful Oz behind the curtain. And in that way, you were seeing God. But that's not really what's meant here. Not physical. It's not that metaphorical imagining, and it's not just in a merely mystical sense. It's seeing God in every possible sense in every area of life. In every sphere of life, we see what we're able to see, and if we're pure-hearted, we see God. If we're not pure-hearted, we see the trash and the dirt and the filth, and we get caught up in it. But if our motives and our minds and our hearts are more closely aligned with what God's desire is for us, then we begin to see God in other places and in other ways, so that even though we may see the person in the gutter, we see somewhere around them the presence of God and the desire of God that they be lifted out of the gutter. We see God in the least of these, my brethren, as Jesus said later on. When you did it to the least of these, you fed them, you clothed them, you visited them, you helped them. When you did it to the Samaritan that was lying in the ditch, you did it unto God. And not you did it to help them out because you thought, you know, if I help this person out, then that'll just get me another star in my crown. But because you truly, if God cares so much that, as the New Testament also says, it is not the will of God that anyone should perish, but that all should be saved, then we will see people and deal with people in a better way because we see them as God sees them, as worthwhile. Doesn't mean we put ourselves in danger and we totally overlook the sinful act that causes pain. But it means that we truly care, we pray for them, and if at all possible, we try to help them to become better. Because they're a child of God as well. The difference in the person that is destitute and in the gutter and living poorly and not even sure if there is a God, but certainly doesn't think God cares. The difference in that person and me might be the acceptance of forgiveness. That's where the difference comes in. Because I'm still a sinner. Every day. But there's a warning here to remember that as by God's grace we keep our hearts clean, or as Barclay says, as by human lust we soil them, we're either fitting or unfitting ourselves to see God. The way we live our lives, the way we think our lives, we are either making ourselves, with God's help, more fit to see God, or we're making ourselves more unfit to see God. And the more unfit we become in our lives to see God, the more fearful we might just be when we do see God. It's difficult to explain and difficult to define sometimes.
We know what we're talking about, or maybe, but you can't get that.
Right.
You can't get that.
And sometimes for all the things we work on and we think through and we say and the ways we try to say the right thing, it's still inadequate because we don't fully understand. Right. We lose that focus. Of course, the other thing is, there are folks out there that will say, well, you know, I don't really understand. I've been trying. I can't really understand, so why continue? And that's where you've just fallen on the slippery slope and you're on your way down. You know, Jesus never said that following God is easy. We try to fool people sometimes by telling them, oh, yeah, you're just come to Jesus moment, everything's going to be okay. That's only if you continue to follow, then somewhere down the road, yeah, everything will be okay. God's going to make it right. But to think it's going to be easy. And a lot of folks drop out because they come and then they have a difficult time and one time and but then they say, well, maybe it'll get better, and then they keep having some difficulty come into their lives here and there. And about the third, fourth, or fifth time something happens, they say, well, somebody sold me a bill of goods, and they walk away. Well, maybe we didn't tell them it's going to be hard. But then again, as I was telling somebody the other day, I said, I was saying this to somebody this morning, too. We were standing in the office talking. I said, if it was meant to be easy, it wouldn't be worth a whole lot. The things that are the most meaningful, the most important, and the things that make the biggest difference are the things that we work for. If it's handed to you, it's not so hard to toss it aside. You work for it, you're not quite as ready to let it completely go. And that's, with the Christian life, that's part of it. Buttrick, who was the editor in general the general editor for the Interpreter's Bible Commentary series, said, I quote, "The poet Shelley insisted that this beatitude is only, quote, a metaphorical repetition of our commonly expressed conviction, virtue is its own reward." Buttrick goes on to say, "But to Christ, God is not an abstract virtue. He is fact. He is life. To the impure man, life is like a stained glass window seen from the outside. But the pure man sees it from the inside, from a true and single motive. God can cleanse the heart on an instant of penitent prayer." End of quote. To the impure man, life is like a stained glass window seen from the outside. To the pure one, sees it from the inside. From a true and single motive that's connected with God. God can cleanse the heart, but I would add something here. God can cleanse the heart on an instant of penitent prayer, but I would say God can cleanse the heart on an instant of truly penitent prayer. Because we can say, boy, I'm sorry, I'm sorry I got caught. Not really mean it was sorry. I really mean it was penitential. But sorry I got caught. And a lot of folks out there that get caught in things, and they say, "Oh, I'm so sorry." But what the, if you listen to them, what the sorry is about is that they got caught. Because you get to check and you find out, well, they've done it not just once and twice, not just three times a lady. No, not once, twice. They've done it a bunch of times and just not gotten caught before. And now they're sorry because they got caught. That kind of cleansing isn't what he's talking about here, that God can cleanse a heart and make it pure on an instant of penitent prayer. It's got to be a truly penitent prayer, where we deep down inside recognize, and with our hearts and our minds, our will and our emotions, we not only recognize that need for God and to be connected more with God, but we also recognize that we have to do something to continue to make that connection work. That is, if we believe that God gives us that choice, and God doesn't just force it on us, and if we believe God forces it on us and we really don't have a choice, then maybe we might as well be a dyed-in-the-wool Calvinist. But throughout the biblical text, we find God saying, choose. Whether he says it verbally, or we have, or there's an opportunity for him to do right or do wrong. That's a choice. In the story in Genesis 3 in the Garden of Eden, that's a choice. Genesis 2, God even calls attention to that choice. And that story. So that, well, I planted this tree right here, and by the way, you need to leave it alone. You need to obey me. For if you don't, you're going to die. Well, they talked about it later on. And if God didn't intend for us to choose, because love and grace that is chosen means more than something that's forced or conformed. Why put the tree in there, and certainly why call attention to it? Choice. And Joshua, before he dies, says, "Choose this day whom you will serve." And the text we read from last week in Deuteronomy, God says, "Choose life that you may have prosperity, or choose death and adversity." And that's what God is saying here. Choose to be pure in heart and have clean hands. Won't always accomplish it. But then again, that also means you can't just sit back and rest on your laurels and say, "Hey, look at what I did. Now bring it on." I'll probably bring this up again at some point. I mentioned it. I didn't intend to mention it tonight, and it just rolled, and then we'll finish, just rolled into my mind. But, afternoon wedding Mary did yesterday, and the priest that was giving the homily was standing up there. It's kind of interesting. And I don't know if, and I do know that his church is in a very bad neighborhood, and they do a lot of stuff. St. Anthony's of Padua do a lot of stuff for the homeless and outcasts and that kind of stuff. But Father Tuttle was standing there, he was talking about the couple and, you know, their love, and said, "You know, all you got to do is, you know, be blessed and just stand in the showers of God's blessings." And then he said, I thought, what? But he said, it's like a giant beer tap that's stuck open forever, and you're standing there and it just keeps pouring out, and you put your mug out there and fill it up, and then when it's almost gone, you just stick it out there and fill it up again. That's standing in the showers of God's blessing. Okay, Father Tuttle. I'm not so sure that that's standing in the showers of God's blessings, but the other thing that he did, he said, you know, he's talking about love, and this is where it came in here, and I was thinking about God and thinking about God's love and connecting here, and what Jesus said, pure in heart and clean hands, that connection with love and sharing love and grace of God. He said, you know, we share love and we share grace. He said, it's not like Jesus came and said, "Hey, check out my love." Huh. I thought, where are you? This is a wedding and you're... Anyway, he was definitely a little bit different. But this pure-heartedness is to be clean and to be pure and to be unalloyed. that is to be right of mind and motive. Not just emotion, but mind and motive with God. And Jesus said, if you attain that, if you even come close, if that's your goal in life, if that's your aim, then guess what? You can see God in other places around the world, in other situations, but in the end, you can see God and not be afraid. God bless you. Go in peace and hang out. There'll be ice cream in a few moments. Thank you.